We will, once that's done, we'll start with the footings and start building up the southern pier, the southern abutment, and working onto the bridge deck. Carol, if you want to hit the next slide, I can.
Sorry, Wes, it's not there. Oops, so
No
sorry. I went.
problem.
There we go.
Yeah, no problem. All right. So kind of as I was saying, we were looking at the profile view on the last slide. This is the plan view. And you can kind of see what we're looking at. So we have the stage 2A coffer cell, which extends downstream of the dike. And this whole area right here is where the stone armor has been installed. This work's been done for the most part. There's a small section in the southwest corner that we still need to do. And there's a small section along this sheet line that we're doing currently. We'll be done with that, if not this week, next week.
Excuse me,
Next week,
Wes. We can't see your
yes.
pointer. If you're trying to
Oh.
point, okay, there it is. Thank you.
I think that's actually Carol's, but
Yeah, just let me know where you want to point, Wes.
okay. So I'll just speak to kind of the words and what we're seeing. Okay, sorry about that. So during this phase of construction, the stage 2A coffer cell is where that stone armor went in, and that's all installed. And then the stage 2B coffer cell is where the actual abutment and pier will be built. So we're going to start excavating that next week. We'll start to really see a lot of material get hauled out of there. Between next week and I believe June, mid-June, we should get down to our sub base and we'll start driving those piles. There's over, 50 to 60 piles in that area. That's going to take roughly a month of pile driving. And then we'll start forming the footings, pouring concrete, and coming up with that structure. It should be noted that during this time, a tidal flow is still being maintained through the existing culverts, and those culverts have not been manipulated or changed in any way. They're in their current or original configuration. So tidal flow has been maintained through there. While we go down in the stage 2B coffer cell, we will be dewatering that with pumps. That will go to a big frac tank. That's the white tank, if anybody's driven by recently, that's staged on top of the dike. And then that water will decant into the stage 2A coffer cell. The total that work in the stage 2B coffer cell of the southern abutment, southern pier, that's going to take us right up through probably the end of 2024 before we start to wrap up that section. At which point we'll kind of flip-flop. We'll move over to the northern portion of the bridge. We'll establish a new configuration for tidal flow that will actually go through our newly constructed southern portion, and then we'll start work on the northern portion. So that's where we stand. Things are moving pretty well, and we look forward to kind of keeping our foot on the pedal and try to get this done. And oh yeah. This is the last slide here. This kind of gives you an idea of what we're actually seeing out there. You can see there's the external coffer cell, which is the 2A area where the stone armor is, and then there's the internal box there. That's where we're going to start excavating next week, and building the southern portion of the bridge.
Great. Thank you,
And I don't
Wes.
know if we want to take questions now, Carol, or if you want
I think we're going to try to get through the slides and then open it up at the end if that's okay.
Yes, please.
Fantastic.
Okay. All right.
Thanks, Wes.
Thank you very
You're
much,
welcome.
Wes. And just a quick update on the status of the low-lying roads and culvert replacements. Many of you may noted there was some interim elevation that just occurred recently. In, I think, right around this area, if I'm not mistaken, Wes.
That's correct, Carly. Yeah,
Yeah, right in that
from
area.
Panic.
Yeah.
Panic point to the entrance to Bound Brook Island Town addressed an area and brought it up a few feet.
Terrific. And so this shows you the outline of the future road elevation and culvert replacements that's proposed. This is still in a final design phase, although getting very close to completion. There was some work over the winter to test some additional geotechnical borings along the embankments to the roads. We're also taking a fresh look at the changes at Duck Harbor to see if that warrants any modifications to the road designs. but feel that that's that phase of work will be moving forward for completion of final design in this coming summer, or possibly even into the early fall, with a potential for bidding late fall or early winter, and construction in winter of 2025. That's the current estimated schedule. And you may see some items popping up on the warrant for the fall town meeting related to easements between that would be granted by the Park Service to the town for the road widening into portions of land that is owned by the National Park Service within the Cape Cod National Seashore. So there'll be more detail coming forward on that in the coming coming weeks. At this point, I'm going to hand it over to Jeff Sanders to provide an update on construction activity with the Mill Creek water control structure.
Okay, thanks, Carol. Can you all hear me?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Thanks, Jeff.
Hello, everyone. Just carrying on with the construction update, as Carol mentioned, the Mill Creek water control structure, the construction has begun. They've cleared the access road and established the staging area and a new truck turnaround. These are some pictures of the existing roadway. The one on the bottom right is coming down from Ultra Quesset Road down towards the creek itself, and the one on the left is looking from the opposite from the. My screen just changed sizes. Give me 1 second. Is looking from the golf course side of the creek back over towards the access road back up to Old Quesset Road. So the contractor is Classic Site Solutions, and they're doing a great job. The next phase of the project is they're actually going to start some in-water work to actually dredge out the creek itself, which if you go down there and you walk down to the creek, you will see where they cut Phragmites to go across, but you'll also notice that actually finding the actual creek channel is quite difficult because it's so choked in with Phragmites. So they've gone in and mapped it, and they are going to, the next phase for them is to actually dredge it out. They're just waiting for their dredge permit to do that. And then following that work, they'll continue on with construction, which will involve driving sheet piles, frames in from, so if you go back to the lower right picture, starting from right around where you see that the wattle sort of bend, they'll start there and knock the sheet piling in down towards the creek and back up the other side. And then the actual water control structure will be in the creek itself, which will consist of flap and sluice gates to control water flow. Just to be very clear again, and just to reiterate, I think some things that we've already mentioned, but this structure is designed, it has gates that will open and close, but the initial settings for this structure will be designed, it'd be set in a way that only water will be able to drain through this structure. So only water coming from upstream. So on the golf course side of the control structure, water coming from upstream will be able to drain through the structure and out into Herring River. No tidal flow will be able to come up through the structure. There will be flap gates that will close to incoming water from downstream, but open to drain water coming upstream. If at some point in time in the future, low-lying properties that exist upstream of the structure are raised or mitigated, then we have the option to open gates to allow tidal flow past the structure and actually achieve some additional restoration. But until that happens, the structure is designed to only allow drainage, no upstream flooding. And anything else here? Okay, Duck Harbor. So we've talked a lot about Duck Harbor. So just for a little bit of history, starting in, I think it was roughly January of 21, there was a breach in the dune there. Water was able to flow into Duck Harbor. And over time, that salt water killed all of the woody vegetation in that system. I think it's important to point out that this is a one-way flow. Water can get in, but it cannot get out. So the only way water drains through this system is out through the river itself. So this is not an inlet. The opening that was originally there in 2021 was probably roughly somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 feet wide. It is now more than 300 feet wide. So these past winter storms really did a number on some of the dunes there. I was out there before a storm. I think it might've been the February storms, and maybe 30 feet of dune was lost in that one storm. It just ripped out the vegetation and opened it right up. So we have this opening that's grown, and that's resulted in a lot more water getting in. And I think as Carol already mentioned this, Duck Harbor, this whole, what's going on there now has nothing to do with the restoration project. Duck Harbor itself is an area that would have been restored as part of the restoration, but that the plan and the thinking was that was all going to happen from the riverside. So once the tide gates opened to Chequesset, water would flow up river and eventually get into Duck Harbor. Well, then this happened. This, what we're seeing there now, has nothing to do with the restoration. The project is doing the best we can to adapt to the current conditions. I guess we can go to the next slide. So there is a lot going on there, and we're seeing some encouraging signs. So clearly we cleared a lot of vegetation there. There was a lot of dead vegetation, and the decision was made to clear that. And I think we're going to get into some of that in a second, but we'll just touch on some of the benefits that we're seeing in Duck Harbor right now. We can start with vegetation. So on the right side, you can see two pictures, top and bottom. The picture on the top was taken in, sorry, my screen keeps switching on me. The picture on the top was taken in early spring. And so you can see there's not much going on there. The picture on the bottom was taken from roughly the same vantage point during the summer, and you can see the amount of vegetation that's grown into the area where the trees were cleared. This is all the vegetation you're seeing there on the bottom right, all that green is all native salt marsh vegetation. So none of it was planted. It all came back on its own, and was very encouraging to see. The other thing that's very encouraging to see is documented in the other pictures here, which is fish. Prior to the overwash, there really was no fish in Duck Harbor. There was a limited hydrologic connection to the river. The system didn't drain very well. But if we're looking for upsides and positives here, the overwash has created habitat not only for salt marsh vegetation, but also for fish. Which have a lot of natural benefits, one of which is they actually like to eat mosquito larvae. So, and in addition to that, we're seeing a lot of other wildlife return to the area. A lot of wading birds, herons, and egrets are using the area. So that's also very, very promising and encouraging. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about vegetation clearing. I think there's been some confusion about some of this, and totally, if this is a complicated project and lots of things are changing, there's a lot of moving parts. So I totally understand the confusion, and we'll try to clear some of that up now. And I'm sure there'll be some questions. So once we get through this, I think we can address any questions that exist on vegetation clearing. So What these maps represent are is the vegetation that the project intends to clear during phase one of the project. And basically, phase one of the project is defined by a certain tide gate scenario, which will raise the mean high water level in the system to roughly 3.6 feet mean high water. So just for everyone's reference, the current mean high water in the system is just over 0 feet. And that's at an that's North American datum 88. That's a vertical datum that we're using to measure elevation. So basically raising the water level mean high water level by an additional 3.5 feet roughly. I think when we initially had planned this out, a lot of the vegetation clearing is dependent on it needs to be timed with the opening of tide gates. Well, a lot of things changed. The construction project was delayed a little bit. Duck Harbor happened, which we weren't expecting. So vegetation clearing was prioritized in different ways. So we started with Duck Harbor, and that was funded through the grant that Carol mentioned, through the North American Wetlands Conservation Act grant, which is administered by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And we partnered with Ducks Unlimited. And so that was what we used to, a portion of that grant, not the entire grant, but a portion of that grant was used to fund vegetation clearing in Duck Harbor and also some other areas in the system. So I think along the way, if the schedule had stayed what it was, and if Duck Harbor hadn't happened, and if the situations hadn't changed, the vegetation clearing may have happened in a different order or manner. Again, this slide was produced prior to any of that other stuff happening. So we obviously had to make some adjustments to the order in which we did things. The plan is still to remove all that vegetation in phase one of the project. So let's get to what we have cut. So here is an image of the bottom image on the right represents the dead vegetation in Duck Harbor, but shows the salt marsh vegetation coming back before we even cut the trees, which was one of the reasons we were one of the reasons we wanted to remove trees in Duck Harbor, because we saw the vegetation coming back. So the image on the right represents the top image represents the contractor and the machine that did the cutting. So in Duck Harbor itself, we cleared 120 acres of dead standing wood. And then beyond Duck Harbor, anyone who's been down to High Toss Road towards the culvert, you'll see there's areas cleared along there, both on the north and south side of the culvert. An additional, the next step would be prior to opening the tide gates, Phragmites along the river will also be cleared. It's essential that that's done in a certain order and in coordination with the opening of the tide gates, because the reintroduction of tidal flow and additional salt water is essential to making sure that that Phragmites is
kept. It's recorded anyway.
Okay.
Go to the next slide. And if I could just ask everyone to please mute if you're not speaking, that would be very helpful so that we can all hear the presentation. Thanks.
Okay. So we're going to get a little bit more into vegetation clearing here. And
do you have it on mute?
I'll confirm it.
For some reason, my screen keeps zooming and zooming out. So
maybe my screen's changing.
Okay, so I mentioned earlier phase one and mean high water. So the you'll see on this screen image slide whatever excuse me the dotted white line, and the dotted white line represents the mean high water level after the initial tide gate opening. Now, the initial tide gates are only going to be open. Excuse me one second. The first tide gate opening are going to be open. We're going to have five tide gates open 2 feet high. Now, that's going to result in raising the water level by approximately 1.6 feet at mean high water. So that's what that white line represents, where we estimate the tide level will be under the first tide gate opening. And that opening will stay at the same, that will remain the same for 3 years. So Based on the current progress in both of the Mill Creek and the Trequestit project, we estimate not being even able to make that opening until 2026. So that means that the water level in the system, mean high water, will not go higher than about a foot and a half higher than it is now, and in up until 2028. And that white line represents roughly where that water level will reach. Now, in at the end of phase one, which will open 7 tide gates as much as
10 feet
high, that is estimated to raise the water level another 1.8 feet. And that's what the red line represents. So this is what we're modeling outputs are what we're using to try to prioritize when and where we need to cut vegetation. I think it's also important to point out that as these tide gates are opened, we will continue monitoring water levels and where things are flooding. And that information will get fed back into this model and inform it even more than it already is. So we'll be able to get a better understanding as we move forward. So, sorry, my screen's going wonky again. So I just wanted to make that clear. Yeah.
Anything else to add on this book?
Yeah. So, Carol, I think we're good on this one.
Okay.
And I think so. We already touched on what was cleared in Duck Harbor. This slide represents the latest clearing effort in Duck Harbor that was done. Well, this is actually more than just Duck Harbor. This represents what was cleared in 2024. So all the areas in yellow are things that the contractor did not get to in 2023. So you can see there are areas in Duck Harbor. The area by the overwash wasn't done in 2023 because we were too close to piping plover breeding season, and the rest of the areas were cleared this year. I don't think there's much else to add for this one, Carol.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff, very mm-hmm. much for that update. And just to perhaps, wrap things up here in terms of the overall project update to give an idea of what is expected in the coming months, bridge construction, which Wes described earlier and certainly can answer questions concerning, is expected to continue through late 2025. As Jeff noted, Phragmites will be cut in Lower Herring River when we reach a point close to when it might be time to start to reintroduce tidal flow. Low road construction, we hope, will be beginning in the early part of 2025 and will continue through late 2026. There are two marsh restoration pilot projects that are in design presently, and we're talking with Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection about these rather innovative pilot projects that are designed to help us understand the best way to assist the marsh in gaining elevation and making sure that we understand, the process by which, colonization of different species will occur under different conditions. So that work is underway as well. It was explained, I think, a little bit by Jeff just a moment ago that the Executive Council has established the first 3-year tide gate management policy. So when we are at a point, which is likely to be, as Jeff mentioned, sometime in 2026, when we are able to reintroduce tidal flow into the system, it will be very incremental with an increase over the first year. And then that level will be maintained for 2 more years to allow monitoring and data collection to occur. So that is, generally the outlook for the coming months and frankly years. And with that, we would be happy to take any questions. I guess we have about 15 more minutes allotted to this topic before the next agenda item, Bill. So would you like us to take a few questions now?
Yeah, I think this is a good idea to get the questions that stakeholders might have. And so why don't we start with that? And again, please keep your questions or advice or comments to like 2 to 3 minutes, please, so we can get everybody in. And we'll get, if we go through this in a reasonably thorough as well as concise kind of way, we'll then later on after the mosquito topic, we'll open it up to the general public. So stakeholders now, and then we'll move forward. Thanks.
I see Barry has his hand raised, and
Barry McLaughlin.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you, Bill. Great presentations, everyone. Thank you for sharing that. I have a two-part question. Essentially, I just want to confirm that the Duck Harbor breach was initially 30 feet, and now it's up to 300, if that's correct. And how much more water is entering the system, and where is it going?
Thanks, Barry. And I would also like to add on to that question. I had heard a rumor, it was unconfirmed, so I don't know for sure, but that the sand might be building up in that area. That somebody had mentioned that perhaps John Portnoy had mentioned that. So while it's wider, it may actually be higher as well. So if Tim or Jeff could answer that, maybe we'd get some more information.
So I guess just to answer it. So yeah, so what I said, Barry, was yeah, I think when the breach was first happened, it was roughly 30 feet. It has grown to more than 300. I don't know, Katie, I don't want to put you on the spot, but Katie Castagno has been doing work out there extensively. And I don't know if you want to, maybe you have more information that you can provide. And again, don't want to put you on the spot, but I guess I just did. So
it's okay. It is what it is. Yeah, sure. So we've been doing a lot of work with Duck Harbor there. We've been really tracking the evolution of the Wash River Fan, which is, you know, a really unique event because in a lot of ways, Wash River Fans tend to, first, they usually happen during storms. So this is unique because we're seeing this happening on these really, you know, kind of beautiful days. We just have a lot of water in the system, and they usually repair themselves over time, right? So if you can imagine, you're bringing in sand, you're building up your elevation, and then that would hopefully make it harder for the overwash to happen again. And we're not really seeing that. We've been taking elevation transects kind of at the mouth, like right across, basically going from north to south along Dark Harbor Beach. And we're seeing some seasonal variation over time, kind of what you would expect, like, you know, your beach will over time gain and lose elevation just kind of naturally. But we are seeing, especially after the winter storms, there was a pretty significant kind of cutout where we're seeing kind of we're losing elevation. But I think what's happening in this case is the sand is kind of going into the system. It's being pushed back, but it's not necessarily building up. But we are monitoring it. So we go pretty regularly. We've taken a little bit of a pause because there was, there were some plovers kind of maybe with a death wish. I always get so sad when I hear the plovers are in there because I know the water's going to come for them. But so we took a little bit of a break while the plovers are here, but we'll be back monitoring the changes in the elevation. So we're keeping an eye on it, certainly.
Thanks, Katie and Jeff. So before we leave that question, does it seem like it would be at least as likely that we will have the same number or even perhaps more frequent overwashes? I don't know that we can draw any conclusions quite yet, but what would be your kind of off the cuff suspicion?
We really don't know. I mean, anything can happen in the sense that, you know, if we have a winter where there's a lot of, like a bunch of storms and it's suddenly bringing in a lot of sediment, like that could really change the system. It could close. I mean, we're not seeing an inlet action, right? Like I think we mentioned where the water is basically going in, but it's not coming out in the same direction. So it's not like it's going back to any sort of like tidal flow right now. But I will say that it seems like we're kind of consistently on track with the tide heights to see water in the basin. To one way or another, it kind of depends again based on the tide height, we're not expecting the like really you know, kind of monumental flooding that we saw, say, in January with every month, with every like astronomically high tide, but I would anticipate water getting into the system at least once a month.
Okay, great. Thanks, Katie. I appreciate the input. I think the next question, we could go to Paul Faxon, and I think he was the next one who would raise his hand. Paul, do you want to?
Sure. Hi, everyone. Thanks for the very thorough presentation. I recognize that it may have been supplemented by some questions that some of us raised in anticipation of this meeting. I have two points. I'll try to be brief. One is, at some point, it would be helpful, and maybe this is about to come up, if Tim Smith could speak about how, if at all, this significant change that everyone acknowledges was not anticipated, the Duck Harbor breach, was integrated into his model. We've heard for many years about the model that was developed. That model was developed without any consideration of a 300-foot breach in growing at Duck Harbor. I just don't know how that gets approached. The second one is a process one. I, along with a lot of our neighbors that are on this call, was really disturbed by the sequence of events in terms of deciding how to allocate funds from Ducks Unlimited for the vegetation removal. It's interesting. Duck Harbor Breach is not part of the project, but when Duck Harbor Breach needs money for vegetation removal, then it is part of the project because that $2 million all of a sudden starts going to that vegetation removal. And I appreciate what Jeff has said, that it's not anticipated that the flooding, the tides will come close to 672 in the next few years. But as the subdivision that's most affected, arguably, by the project, I think we need to have a plan about how that vegetation removal will happen in the future along Way 672, along Chequesset Knolls and Newcomb Hill, and whether there's any urgency to arrange funding for that. So those are my two questions. Thank you.
Bill, do you want us to try to address that now?
Well, yeah, if you would, Jeff, that'd be great. You or Tim, perhaps, that'd be perfect. Thanks.
Yeah, so Tim can speak to the modeling question, and then I can cover the second question that Paul had.
So the question on modeling, so it's not my model. It was a model developed by Woods Hole Group for on behalf of the project. And the past year or so, we've been in discussion with them about revisiting and updating the model to incorporate the effect of Duck Harbor on the results. And that's pending right now. And when we have results from that, we'll take a look at those and integrate them as necessary.
And then I think, Paul, your other question was about Duck Harbor. And so you're correct in that the breach itself and the flooding of Duck Harbor was not part of the project. That happened independent of any restoration activity. However, the area, Duck Harbor area, is included in the restoration regardless of whether the overwash happened or not. Eventually, the tide gates would have been open enough at Chequesset to flood Duck Harbor and restore that area. So, I mean, the vegetation was cleared there for a number of reasons, including at the time, you may recall in 21 or and maybe even into 22, we were experiencing a drought. There were concerns about wildfire and that much standing dead wood. That contributed to it. Also, there were the ecological reasons that I already mentioned about vegetation coming back. Duck Harbor, this was seen as an opportunity to gain information that will inform the restoration, the rest of the restoration, right? So this happened ahead of, before we ever thought it would. Clearing the vegetation and allowing salt marsh plants to return, basically would allow us to use Duck Harbor as a giant macrocosm experiment. That would help us then take information we learned there from studies like the one that Katie's doing and apply that information across the rest of the project to better inform the restoration. So I totally understand what you're saying as far as how things reordered. That's I hope that made sense. And let me know. I can clarify further if needed.
Here's one question that I have that's kind of on the same topic, Jeff, is that the dashed line and I believe the red line all are based on raising the gates at the dike. But now with the introduction of overwash being a potential contributor to the inflow, it strikes me that it might, from a scheduling standpoint, be important to remove the vegetation that is between ITOS and the dike prior to removing the dirt from ITOS, so that water from Deck Harbor, any other future overwashes, doesn't get down to the construction sites. And the subdivision that Paul, you know, mentioned earlier, and, you know, all along way 672. So from a scheduling standpoint, you might want to consider that. Are there any other comments on that particular topic? If not, then let's move to Laura. I think she has the next, Laura Runkle, the next question.
So thank you. I sent a couple of pics around because we were observing the effects of the overwash as far east as the upper Poldike Creek area, and right up against our house when this started at the beginning of the year, and it happened several times. And this had never happened before. We know that the water could get whoever it can run to, but we always felt that this was, I guess, more a far enough distance away from what was going on over there that it wouldn't be impacting our house. And I guess when I think about adaptive management and see things like this happening, regardless of whether this is part of the planned inclusion in the project, I'm wondering if people are looking at it more broadly now when things like this are happening.
So this is Jeff. I'll start out by saying that as the flooding has increased, there's been a lot of talk about amongst the project team, also in conjunction with folks from the town, about what could be done. It's difficult because there's so much water coming in through Duck Harbor on these big king tides, and the tidal input from Duck Harbor during an overwash doesn't necessarily sync up with the tidal input through the dike structure on a high tide there. So that's out of sync. Mm-hmm. And they, once all that water gets into Duck Harbor and into the river, it kind of builds upon itself because it all has to drain through these really tiny culverts. And so I think the largest of those culverts is 5 feet, and that's the one at High Toss Road, and the ones at Boundbrook Island and Old County are even smaller than that. So it's a challenge. We've talked a lot about things that could happen and could be done. And we've talked about, can we improve drainage by removing the culvert at High Toss? Well, as Wes can tell you, that creates incredibly big complications for the construction project downstream and opens up a lot of different questions. So all that water is being pushed up into Upper Poldike Creek, like you said, Upper Bound Brook, because there's too much water in the system on these big overwashes. But there's definitely things that we've discussed. I don't know if anyone else has anything to add there. It's just it's a tough nut to crack.
Mm-hmm. Just one other thing I wanted to say is the drainage out of this area, this basin, has been getting worse over years before the overwash. And I believe part of that is because the channel over into the phase one area, and I guess it's, I'm not sure what they call that culvert, but It goes under, I believe, Polbeck Road, and it's jammed with vegetation and doesn't drain, which has not helped the problem, the drainage from a while back. Thank you.
One other thing that I think might be worth mentioning, and maybe I'm mistaken about this, but I believe that the modeling and the adaptive management that is mentioned and has been mentioned a number of times is basically related to the opening of the gates at the dike when it's new, as opposed to the adaptations that are necessary while under construction. Now, Jeff or Tim, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that, that's where the modeling is was actually designed to provide insights.
Yeah, Bill, you're correct. That is right. And just to go back to how a lot of these issues could be addressed is once the roads are raised, once the culverts are removed, once the gates are opened, that should help address this drainage problem we have in the system. So I know that's not something that's going to happen tomorrow or next week, but the project moving forward will be the ultimate solution to the issues we're seeing and with all of the buildup of water.
Great, thanks. The next question, I think, Helen, you had a question?
Yeah, I have a comment, and then later when you, I'm not on the stakeholders group, but later I'll have questions as a member of the public. The comment I wanted to make addresses something that Jeff Saunders, you said. So I'm a member of the Herring River Executive Council. I'm not speaking as a delegate right now, but I was there for the very, very important, carefully considered vote as to how fast and how much. And we were given excellent options. I felt very good about that meeting, given that we had a lot of data to go with. The option that was voted on that night was exactly what Jeff said. For the first 3 years, it would be open just so much, right? And it was a little more particular. But there was an important thing that got said, which I remember because I brought it up. And it was acknowledged. And it wasn't in the motion, if we did a motion. Which is, let's say, according to plan, the gates start getting opened as we decided to do it over 3 years. What I said was, if the overarching concept here is adaptive management, right? So if it turns out that that isn't a good way to go with it, if, for example, we need more salt water and more of a tidal exchange more quickly, we could meet, deliberate, get advice from the Herring River technical team and do it. So there's a plan, you need a plan, but if the plan doesn't work, this is what I'm underlining. It was discussed in that meeting that it could be tweaked because, as we've just seen with the overwash, things could not go as planned. So that's what I wanted to add to this. And it would be good to mention that, that it's truly adaptable. Thank you.
Great, thank you. I don't see any other questions, Mike. Computer screen is jumping around here a little bit. So, Carol, if you see any other questions.
I don't see any other hands raised at the moment.
Folks, there's two questions in the chat.
Barry has asked about the amount of water coming in the breach. Is it greater and where is it going? I believe it is greater it's having a hard time draining out of the system, but Jeff or Tim, do you want to add any more to that?
No, I think that it's like we were saying, it just gets, there's not enough open, there's not enough drainage, so it actually gets pushed further upstream into the Cold Lake watershed and the Bound Brook watershed.
And then Josh Yeston has said, has it been considered to refill the breach with sand to plug the hole, which I believe was considered, but Jeff, do you want to address that one?
Yeah, no, we discussed this. I mean, when the breach initially happened in 2021, we talked about not necessarily refilling it, but do we put snow fencing up there? Do we do something to try to have something capture sand? And we talked to a lot of experts in this area, and we're basically told that, you know, you can do what you want to do, but the ocean's going to go where the ocean wants to go. And so, you know, at the time, we didn't take any action. And, you know, more recently we have discussed whether it makes sense to fill that area in. And I think it's an incredibly expensive endeavor that requires a lot of permitting. And I think in the end it goes back to the ocean's going to go where the ocean's going to go. And I think a lot of people point to, what's the beach in Troy?
Boston
Beach, where they had the overwash at Boston, and the town put sand after sand after sand there, and the ocean wiped it out. And then finally they adapted to it. And I think they've come with us, you know, that's turned out to be the best solution, not necessarily dumping sand, but more trying to adapt. So, anyway, I think that's a long-winded way of saying, yeah, we've discussed it and, determined that it probably wasn't the most prudent way forward.
Thanks, Jeff. And I think Jordan is the last hand up on this. And I know, Bill, you have other agenda items you need to get to.
Yep. Thank you.
Hello. Thanks. I just had a question about the pilot projects for the salt marshes that you mentioned. I wondered if you had any more information about that.
Tim?
Hi, this is Tim. These are two small, we call them demonstration level projects of thin layer placement, using material within the system to raise elevation of subsided marshes. And I've presented some of that, I think, to this group in the past. Probably the next meeting will be a lot more information to talk about.
Awesome, thanks.
Hey, one more thing. I just want to follow up on a little bit on what Paul had asked about. The last question that he mentioned was about the funding for the vegetation removal continuation. I'm sure that you're working on it, Jeff. Maybe you want to give a few words onto how you're looking to refill that particular bucket.
Yeah, I think between all, you know, as Carol pointed out early on, this project is a collaborative partnership that involves a lot of federal and state agencies and nonprofit groups and local agencies. So I think we're all working together to try to address the funding needs for whether it's vegetation, habitat management, you name it. But I think a lot of this has to be done It also comes down to timing, right? So, you know, if you get money for something, this money has a timeline associated with it. So especially federal dollars, you get federal dollars, you have a specific amount of time in which you have to spend that money. Otherwise, the federal treasury takes it back. So we can't, it doesn't help us to get money today that we're not going to use for, you know, 4, 5, 6 years. So, you know, as we were talking about with the timing of the restoration, so well, some things we kind of have to figure out when to get the money in order to implement certain things based on when the tide gates are going to open and certain things are going to be flooded. So it's not as necessarily as easy as just saying, let's go out and get the money. It has to be done in concert with all these other things. But yeah, I think all of the agencies involved are working together to try to address the funding issues.
All right. Thanks. All right. I think that the next thing would be a presentation by Gabby. Yep. If Gabby Sikalski, do you want to take it from here?
Sure. I think Helen Miranda is signaling that she wants to say something.
Oh. Yes. Forgive me, Bill. If you remember, I said I had two questions. I made a comment, but they apply to what has just been discussed. So Jeff Saunders just said, that yes, the park considered building up the area along Duck Harbor Beach to keep more water from going in. But did you, this is a question I've gotten from more than three people, several people. Why is it that the park can't open that up for more tidal exchange, which might mitigate the water that's going all the way through into the harbor that's creating a plume of not toxic, but very, if I'm saying this correctly, John Portnoy, oxidized, you know, iron content going into the harbor. There's kind of a plume of water going in. Would it be possible for the park to open up Duck Harbor more to get permission to do that so that the tidal exchange would be better and frankly, so the fish would have a better chance? And then the other question that a number of people have asked that I'm passing along is, when is the vegetation that you see along Poldike Road between High Toss Road and Coles Neck Road going to be cleared, thawed, whatever you're going to do with it? So two questions. Thank you for letting me ask them now.
So thanks, Helen. To your first question about actually manipulating Duck Harbor to turn it into an inlet. So that's not as easy as just the park going in to do it. I think that's technically, that area in there is technically town beach. So it would have to be done in conjunction with the town. There would be obviously a lot of permitting involved in doing that. And, you know, again, I think these are things that we've discussed with coastal geomorphologists. And I think it does go back to, you know, I don't think inlets were things that were meant to be created by man. So I don't know if it's as easy as just saying we do it. It would probably have to be a lot of work involved in studying to see whether that actually made sense. The second question had to do with timing of clearing of vegetation in a certain spot. Poldike Road Creek?
Between High Toss Road,
yes,
towards the dump to Coles Neck Road, that whole area there.
Yeah.
For a long time, a lot of brush.
You're asking about when that will be cleared?
Yeah, ballpark.
Do you have a ballpark on that? I don't know that we can, at this point, I don't know that we know. Yeah, we'd have to go back and look for that information, but we can get back to you on that.
I think Al Kraft has a question.
Yeah, I'll try to make it quick. I'm going to a tunnel here. I'm sorry. But a follow-up to Helen's observation, is it possible to, when the contractor is going to remove the original tide gates at the Chiquesset Dike, and they're going to reestablish structure there to allow water to come through, to widen that up and then open up High Toss to allow some water out of the system and then have it flow out of the main dike on Chiquesset Neck Road, might that alleviate some of the problems of the backup above High Toss?
Al, this is Jeff. I just want to make sure we understand the question. So are you asking during the construction process, is it possible to do that? Or after the bridge is completed at Chiquesset Neck Road?
No, during the construction project, because the contractor is going to reestablish some sort of a new tide gate because they've got to remove the old one, as I understand it.
You're correct. At that point,
could that be opened wider and then that would allow water from above High Toss to get out?
Wes, are you comfortable trying to address that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think everything's within, you know, everything that's doable is doable. So from a pragmatic approach, could you increase tidal flow with our temporary, you know, water control structure that we have to establish when we start working on the north side of the bridge? Yes, it could be done. How that's done, you know, we just have to work through the engineering end of that. The contract documents state that MIG, the contractor, needs to, you know, when they establish that temporary water control, when they start working on the northern side of the bridge, that they maintain the existing flow. So that's what they're, that's what they originally are thinking, and that's what they are intending on doing. So this would, this just intends, or just, it would require cooperation with the contractor, kind of additional work by the engineering teams, just to try to really pin that down and how that would happen. So it's, you know, I think it's doable. It just, you have to bear, you have to take into consideration a lot of variables. Because one of the concerns that Jeff alluded to earlier was that if you just take out high toss without accounting for that water coming down, you know, we have sheets in there that are intended to keep the water out. And if those sheets overtop, or, you know, our work zone gets flooded out and you have concrete here, and, you know, it could just be, you know, it's just not a good situation. So, but yeah, something to consider and a conversation that can be had.
Thank you.
Okay, I think let's move on to Gabby, and we'll come back to questions, time allowing, following her presentation.
Sure. Thanks for giving me some time today. We've been getting a lot of calls from concerned citizens in the area that are experiencing a higher than usual mosquito population. We're doing trapping in the area, so we know that that is comparably higher than usual in that area. So I'll go back a little bit. This all ties into that mosquito emergence that we had after the overwash at Duck Harbor back in 2021. Once we had the overwash, we had increased habitat for mosquitoes. We had originally brackish water mosquitoes inundating the area, and then eventually saltwater mosquitoes inundating the area. Those mosquitoes spread out throughout the Herring River Basin and laid their eggs everywhere. Those eggs will sit there for 10 years easily, waiting to be inundated again. Unfortunately, with the storms that came this spring, winter, we had inundation of areas that haven't been inundated in a while, or at least since that 2021 outbreak of mosquitoes. And so what we're seeing initially are those brackish water mosquitoes hatching in all of those areas where there is water standing. Unfortunately, we're dealing with a few issues on the side of trying to control those mosquitoes. Maybe you'll remember after the summer of 2021, I had crews go in there in the wintertime through Duck Harbor and open up the drainage ditches so that that water could flow straight through the system and out towards Herring River into the basin and then out. So that provided us with moving water, and it provided us with fish access to different locations where there might be standing water. After the vegetation management occurred that winter, we had a lot of woody debris in the system. So there was a lot of benefit to the vegetation management. I will say that it allowed our crews to get more access. It allowed our crews to, it allowed the area to be sunny. And so we would have areas dry up again. But with the increased vegetation management, now we have more woody debris sitting in different sections of Duck Harbor in different locations. So one of our issues is, especially in the Duck Harbor area, there's water standing under that woody debris. And with the larvicide products we use, it's very difficult for us to get those into the water where those mosquitoes are developing. We also have been talking with the seashore about a special use permit for this summer to increase the area where we can apply larvicide, where we have access. And I have to say, we're still in discussions about Duck Harbor because of the fish project that they're doing there and how that will interact with our larvicide treatments. In other sections of the Herring River Basin, so I know that this isn't necessarily related to any restoration work, but this is the Herring River Basin where we're going to be adding salt water eventually. We're definitely looking at areas where water is being held up and creating areas where mosquitoes are developing. A lot of that area is inaccessible to us right now. So we're looking at different ways where we could approach it through water management to open up at least a few places to get water moving and to allow fish access a little more easily. So we've also been talking to the seashore about an addendum to our SUP for this year that would allow for that. And it sounds like that's going smoothly and we're working towards that. There are a few blocks in Poldike Creek that might assist in moving water out of Upper Poldike area, because that water's sitting and we're getting mosquitoes up there in places that we don't expect as well, or that we don't want as well. So for us, it's looking at the situation, which is constantly changing. That whole idea of adaptive management, we're constantly trying to focus on the areas where the mosquitoes are developing, but it's very timely. And being able to move crews into the area to get this work done immediately is very difficult right now. We're coming into a season where the Department of Public Health in Massachusetts is predicting increased risk for transmission of Eastern equine encephalitis. So I have to put resources towards areas where that might be occurring. So that's more my freshwater mosquitoes. Although we have in the past had triple E positive mosquitoes in the ponds area in Wellfleet as well. So we're working to try to balance our efforts. It's a stretch, I'll say, and we're doing what we can. So I guess that's my update. I'd like to say that I'm optimistic, but we're just taking it step by step. Things keep changing in this system, and we're trying to approach it as much as we can, but my resources are quite limited and they're being stretched to the limits with all of this.
Thanks, Gabby.
That was a lot. I hope that sort of put it together, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Gabby. It strikes me that with the water that's coming in via Duck Harbor Overwash, that's accelerating what would have otherwise taken place anyway. Is that correct?
That's correct. And so we're looking at places where, and when this project, when the restoration project was first discussed, it was something that was discussed, that there would be low-lying areas where mosquito situations may occur and we'll need to be able to deal with those in a timely manner. And I think that we're just going to have to work on some planning as we go forward, because I think this is not a unique situation this year. I think this is a continuing situation.
Well, and the idea that it's accelerating the problem that will eventually or would have eventually taken place anyway. Is there a way then to potentially accelerate the cash flow to go along with the solution to the problem that would have taken place? And that isn't probably your decision to make, and it probably isn't anybody else's here's their decision either, but has that been considered? If you need more resources, what's the best avenue to go?
I think that that's what we're going to have to talk about going forward, definitely. Because we're able to partner on other projects around the Cape. Saltmarsh restoration projects, we've partnered with other organizations in the past. We have the people, the equipment, the expertise to do work in salt marshes, and we have the knowledge of where the issues are and what we can do to solve the mosquito problems. It's really a resource problem right now for us.
Resource meaning money.
Meaning money. Money to get people out there doing the work. And I'm happy to collaborate with, I know there have been some discussions about collaborating with the seashore for assistance with that. It's a lot of work, and it's very physical work, and it's work that my employees do all the time. So they are experts at it.
Okay. If that's the update, then maybe we open it up to, first of all, are there any questions from the stakeholders group? And if not, then let's open it up to the general public. Yes, Lillianne.
Thank you very much for this time to ask a question. Well, if Gabby has offered, it sounds like she's offered her staff and who is very knowledgeable and it has expertise, how do we move this forward, and what would the recommendations be moving forward to get this done so it doesn't get worse?
I don't know that I have the answer. I certainly don't. So I guess it's between Gabby. It could be the town. It could be Friends of Herring River or some other potential funding source, I suppose.
Does that mean that some action steps are going to take place, or does it mean that there's just been a meeting, there's a problem identified, and then it just is like, I want to say a hanging chat? I don't know.
Gabby, do you have conversations with the seashore about added resources?
Yes, and I guess if anybody, Jeff could speak to that. I have discussed it. In fact, this fall, I brought it up that we were running on a limited budget with limited resources. I don't know that the seashore is in a place to, and I shouldn't maybe speak for them, but the impression I have is that they're not in a place to provide any funding at this time for work that's being done within their boundaries for mosquito control. Yeah, so there was an offer of assistance with help from perhaps some of their staff. But maybe Jeff should speak to that, or somebody else from the seashore.
Yeah, I mean, this is Jeff. So I think there's two issues. One is, regardless of whether there's funds or not, which we don't have available funds right now at the park, but we don't have a mechanism to pass funds on to the county.
To the state, Jeff. We're a state agency.
I don't think we have a mechanism that would allow us to easily do that right now. So those are the two primary issues we would have.
Is there somebody else that will step up to the plate and help the situation?
Well, I see Helen's hands up, but I'm not too sure that she may have a question more than an answer, but let's hear what Helen has to say.
Thank you, Bill. One of the reasons I brought up the option, and Jeff, you didn't say it was impossible, you just said it would be difficult, and that's good. It's good that the park can't just sort of cavalierly... But if there was more tidal flushing and tidal influence from the Duck Harbor end of things, there would be fewer mosquitoes there. The main problem in this part of Wellfleet and the Outer Cape with mosquitoes, if I'm not mistaken, is because of the overwash. So that was the first thing. The other thing is, it is going to be different because of climate change generally, because it's warmer, mosquitoes are going to be, you know, we may have malaria here in 50 years, who knows? But I have changed my habits. I did it 2 years ago, and magic thinking and thinking that there can be some solution that comes from the town or the state or the county, I don't think like that. I think, how do I dress? I certainly don't have, you know, pesticide companies coming in and spraying on my property because mosquitoes, you know, have huge ranges of many miles. And I've changed my habits. It's a drag. I hated it 2 years ago, but that's the most important thing I can do. And otherwise, short of there being a major influx of water in and out twice a day, with the fish really getting to flourish there, it's going to be like that. Gabby was very specific about the problems with treating that area, and I appreciated the detail. Thank you.
Yeah, I would only say that when we have approached problems in other locations where we've historically done work, we haven't had an issue. And we do work all over Cape Cod in salt marshes and in other environments where we don't have the same problem. So I think that, and I think that when we looked at it after 2021 and we looked at where the problem was coming from and we offered some solutions and we had the resources and the permits to do so, I think that people saw a difference in the mosquito populations that next summer. We've been doing this for a long time. Just to answer a few of the questions that I see in chat, Barry asked if we're testing mosquitoes in the project areas. So we have trap site at Herring River and we have a trap site in the ponds in Wellfleet. So at both ends of that system, we're collecting mosquitoes from those traps on a weekly basis, identifying them to species. And as of the middle of June, when we find species that are capable of vectoring disease, we will be submitting those to the state labs for testing on a weekly basis. So they will be tested. The state labs has not yet started testing, but we are definitely trapping in those two locations, and we have been for about a month now. And John Portnoy said the existing flooding floodwater mosquito production is not a preview of what to expect with the tidal restoration. The latter will be greatly improved low tide drainage. So my only comment to that is that's looking long term, and I have to focus on what's happening sooner. I don't know where those low points are, and I know that you've got modeling, and I know that you're addressing how the models have changed with the Dock Harbor overwash. But I think that you have to assume that there are going to be places where fish can't get in and where there's not going to be drainage and where we're going to have to go in and open up those creeks again or remove that tree that's sitting in Poldike Creek right now or any of those things that can help drainage happen. It's not just open it up and it's going to happen. It's going to take a lot of work to get back to where things are moving. That's just my comments. And Josh, my goodness, I need my reading glasses. And Josh asked, is octanol effective at attracting mosquitoes? It depends on the species of mosquitoes. It's actually not that effective at attracting the salt marsh mosquitoes for some reason. Octanol is effective at attracting no-see-ums by the bajillions and greenhead flies. But some of the species of mosquitoes, for whatever reason, aren't attracted to it.
Carol, I think you have a question.
Yeah, just in follow-up to John's comment, I mean, I think it is an important one, and I certainly take Gabby's point that it's not going to happen immediately, but tidal restoration will improve drainage. It's going to increase the ability for fish to get into the system. So, I mean, I just think to the comments made earlier that, well, we're sort of where we're going to get to anyway with tidal restoration. I think John's comment really kind of puts that in proper context, that the restoration will be an improvement and we shouldn't expect that this is the outcome that would result from tidal restoration. I think it just gets to that discussion about cause and effect and tidal restoration and mosquito population. Tidal restoration will be a benefit to that problem.
Thanks. And Jeff, you want to make a comment?
I'll actually let Paul go, and then I'll go after Paul.
Okay, Paul.
Just two funding thoughts. One, with respect to the mosquito control, is there a possibility of having the town of Wellfleet, now that it's able to, you know, certify its free cash, be a contributor to providing some resources to the Cape Cod Mosquito Control Project? And two, in terms of funding for vegetation removal along Way 672, I do think there needs to be a concerted effort to begin looking for that funding. I believe the Friends might have been involved in the past with the Ducks Unlimited funding, and the Ducks Unlimited grant came years and years and years before there was ever any vegetation removal. So the need to begin lining up those funds that have now been reallocated in part to the Duck Harbor overwash, I think, are important to consider. Thank you.
Jeff?
Yeah, I'll just close by saying, so first to Paul, yeah, we hear you and we'll continue working to, as far as the vegetation clearing goes, to try to find funding. And then regarding, you know, the park and collaboration with mosquito control, I mean, we talk a lot, Gabby and I, we have not denied any requests they've had. I think a lot of times there is some, we do talk back and forth about specifics about things because We do have things going on that we need to just understand. Well, if they treat here, how's that going to impact some of the things that we have working on? But we've not denied any requests, and we'll continue to support as best we can anything that they want to do in the system. We understand the issue and the concerns about mosquito control. Understanding that we can't necessarily provide funding to support their actions, but we will continue to cooperate and work with them through this.
Any other questions? Okay, well, I think that pretty much concludes what we had in mind. I will mention that the next meeting is going to be in November sometime. There's some thought about possibly having it be on site or physical, everybody get together in some location, or a hybrid. If you've got preferences on that, let me know, please. In the meantime, I'll keep everybody informed in the stakeholders group when the upcoming Herring River Executive Committee meetings are, so that we can attend those as well. And rather than duplicate, meeting upon meeting that discusses the same thing, I would recommend and suggest and encourage people to attend the Executive Committee meetings. Carol, did you have anything else you wanted to say?
Just to follow on that, Bill, thank you. The next Executive Council meeting is June 13th at 3:00, which will be via Zoom. So we'll provide you with that access information that you can circulate to the stakeholders.
Great. Okay, in which case I would like to move to adjourn. Do I have a second? Anybody?
I'll second.
Okay, I don't know that we need to vote on it. I think we can just go our separate ways.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, everyone.